Hi, everybody. Everybody having a good time at Comic-Con this year?
Yeah!
I'm honored to be here today to introduce one of our special guests. It's rare that I get to stand up here and use the triple threat of writer, artist, actor. But most of you are familiar with Larry Hama's work on G.I. Joe, and we're very, very pleased to have him here to help celebrate the 30th anniversary of the character in comics. It's also my great honor to be here today on behalf of Comic-Con International to give to Larry our Inkpot Award for Achievement in Comic Arts.
Some of them have been going on for 3 years. Those are ones that are covered by NDAs I can't talk about. So I've been, you know, sort of really frustrated about that. But what can you do? But anyway, I'd pretty much like to just open it up to questions. And, you know, I'll try to deal with them as best as I can. So why don't we just get started with that? You, sir.
How does it feel after so many years that Silent Interlude issue 21 is still respected as one of the greatest comics ever written?
Written?
Plotted, I guess, would be a better word.
Well, you know, that's all this stuff is very surprising, was always very surprising to me. I mean, because, well first off, you know, I took on G.I. Joe because I was literally the last one they asked. You know, at the time in 1981, working on a toy book was sort of the bottom of the barrel. The companies had licensed books were like that. The companies paid you a lower rate for working on a licensed book because the licensing fee came off the top. They had to pay for that first, and then you got paid. And the only way a lot of the guys could get in the door at the time was to be doing these types of books. You know, in fact, you know, something like Barry Smith, you know, the reason he got Conan to do was because, you know, John Buscema, they couldn't really afford John Buscema's rate because, you know, the publishers, no, we can't afford to pay a top-rated guy like Buscema to do a book that we're paying a licensing fee on. So that was Barry's big break. And G.I. Joe was my break in that they asked every single writer they had on contract or available, they all turned it down. Then they went down editor's row and started asking all the editor writers and the assistant editors. And I was the editor at the time, and my office was the absolute last office in the row. So they got to be last, and I said, well, sure, I'll do it. What is it? You know? And literally, if it had been Barbie, I would have jumped at the chance to do Barbie. nobody expected it to go beyond 6 or 12 issues because licensed toy books never did until that point. And in fact, when we got to the two-year point, everybody was just sort of expecting it to just, well, especially since the toy companies, as Hasbro, they were following the sort of established wisdom of the times, which everybody was just scared of getting stuck with another Cabbage Patch doll, you know, that which was a catastrophe for the toy industry, where they figured, oh, we hit a gold mine here, and it's going to go on forever. And then that one Christmas, they got caught flat-footed with, you know, hundreds of warehouses full of these ugly things. And nobody wanted them anymore. It was, you know, the precursor of what happened to Meaty Babies. Okay, now this seems like a roundabout way to get to your answer, but I'm getting there. That, so at year two, they were getting ready to shut down the shop all across the board. You know, they said, well, you know, this is, you know, do we want to risk going a third year? And they took that gamble, and it paid off. So, but, you know, you have to understand that this was where issue 21 comes in. Numerically, this is how it figures in, is that, you know, nobody was really sort of keeping an eye on things, and somehow things went awry on scheduling, and we had to get out the next issue of G.I. Joe in about half the time that it usually took to get one out. And everything was really close to the wire. And I said, well, how can we possibly do this? And I said, well, look, if I pencil it, do breakdowns simultaneously as writing it, and like, that saves us a week. So let's make it an issue with no balloons. And if we make it an issue with no balloons, then we save a week on the lettering, because at that point there was no email, there was no JPEGs. To get something lettered, we had to send the physical pages to the pencil pages to the letterer by FedEx. It took 2 to 3 days to letter, then they had to ship it back. So it was about a week combined. It was shipping time and work time. So I said, well, without lettering, we save a week. So without a script, we save another week. So we're saving, and if we have somebody really fast, like Steve Leoloa, do finishes of my breakdowns, we save another week. And that was the only reason we did it. It wasn't, you know, people sitting there in a meeting going, oh, this is a wonderful sort of artistic, you know, new idea. It was, got to get the book out, you know. And in fact, when it was published, we got numbers of letters from kids saying, hey, I got a defective issue. All the letters fell off of my comic. They literally thought that something could, because they never seen a comic with no captions or balloons. And they were convinced that it was some sort of mistake or defect. And then we got even more letters from kids saying, well, I felt really cheated that there were no words, because I got through the whole issue in like 3 minutes, you know, and like I should get at least, you know, 10 minutes worth of, you know, reading out of this thing, and like I want my money back. So there was initially a lot of negative reaction to it, and never got anything really sort of positive until many, many, many years later. It's you know, it was one of those things that it just didn't seem like anything at the time. You know, the other thing that didn't seem like anything at the time was the fact that I really didn't use a lot of captions, and I didn't use thought balloons. Everything was dialogue, and if there was a caption, it was, well, meanwhile, at the pit, you know, period. And this is at a period when about a third of the wording on a Marvel page was captions. It was all purple prose, you know. Mortally, he slipped through the ebon darkness as stabbing rays of violet light, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, this was reactionary on my part because, you know, I'd been working as a penciler until then. And I'd done one job where the writer had asked for this the scene that took place in the Himalayas with this character we are walking through this pass in the mountains, and I spent like a whole day just on this one page doing this, you know, meticulously drawing this mountain range and the backgrounds and like these roiling clouds and a thunderstorm breaking between the mountains and the pass, and, you know, swarms of birds and stuff. And when I finally saw the finished book, the writer had decided to put in something like 10 or 12 captions that covered all that stuff. But what was in the captions was just stuff describing the stuff that was covered up. As he walks through the valley between the towering mountains and the billowing clouds, and I was thinking, you know, this is like really useless and senseless. And I said, well, I'm never going to do this, you know. There has to be a way to tell the story pretty much in the pictures, and that's how I've always thought of it. I don't write. I mean, I don't consider myself a writer. I consider myself a penciler with a word processor because I picture the whole story in my head as a series of visual images completely. I try to see the whole thing as a silent movie. And then when I get to the actual word processor, all I'm doing is describing the movie I see in my head. And that's what I give to the penciler. I still work in the old, what they call the Marvel style, which is a plot. And then the whole story is drawn from the plot. And then I add in the dialogue and whatever captions there are after the fact. This is switched back to predominantly full scripts now, which are more like screenplays, where the writer describes what's in the visual image. And I think that's a step backwards, personally, because it's a visual medium. I think that the control of the visual and the storytelling should be in the hands of the artist rather than the writer. And it's very hard to make that jump. But in the meantime, you know, I was castigated when I first started doing GIO, because I said, well, you got to have captions, you got to have thought balloons, you know. But gradually the entire industry sort of came around to my way of thinking. And now that whole overblown style of like too many captions is very passé, and it's all just dialogue. Anyway, did I answer your question?
Yes.
Yes, sir, in the back. You have to speak up a little bit. I'm a little hard of hearing.
You talked a little bit about, you know, in the 80s there were a lot of ninjas and everything, and also G.I. Joe and Boston, they also sort of came around to everyone involved with like a lot of ninjas. This is a serious question, so can you talk about a personal preference or like a market driven thing?
For ninjas?
Yeah.
Well, I liked the whole concept of ninjas from as a kid. You know, I would see them. I grew up in New York City, And, you know, our only touchstone to, my only touchstone to my Japanese American culture was that there was a Japanese American Buddhist church that, instead of having bingo, you know, for fundraising, they would show Japanese movies on Sunday afternoon, and kids got it free. So, like, you know, my mom would always sort of deposit me there, like sort of free babysitting. You know, so I'd be sitting there in the first row with, like, you know, 10 other kids, and we'd watch Zatoichi and, you know, the One-Armed Swordsman and, you know, Kyoshiro Nemuri, the mystic swordsman. And then there were always these ninja movies, you know, black and white ninja movies from the 50s and 60s. Which were less about, you know, the sort of the American concept of ninja as like a super warrior than mystic occultist stuff. In fact, they didn't even use the word ninja in the subtitles. You know, the ninja would show up and they would say, oh, it's the occultist or the magical fighter. Yet they had all these other things that would skirt the term ninja. And, you know, and it was all about, you know, mystic finger knitting and being able to, like, create illusions and, you know, being able to walk across rooms silently or creeping along the ceilings. And that's what I found really fascinating. And, you know, there had been ninjas sprouting up here and there in comics, specifically, you know, guys like Mike Kaluta, who's interested in this stuff. But no one was really doing it from that mystic point of view, and that's what I wanted to sort of get in there. And that was my interest in this stuff. Yes, sir, in the back. A day in the Marvel bullpen?
Yeah.
Well, I served in the U.S. Army. I was engineers, not the Corps of Engineers. Went in 69, got out in 71. Was in a number of places, some of which I can't even talk about. But I was in the infantry. The way that relates to what I do is that I understand how soldiers feel and talk, basically. And, you know, you have to understand about soldiers and cops and firemen and EMTs that if you're not one of them, they're not telling you the whole story, ever. And that's true all the way down the line. You learn that there's just stuff that you just can't really tell to people that weren't there because they just won't get it. And, you know, I'm not really relating stuff about my experiences. You know, my best talent is I'm a fairly good listener. You know, I just try to absorb everything around me. A lot of the stuff that goes into the stories is stuff that I've absorbed that way. You know, some of it is secondhand, but some of it is firsthand. And I try to filter it through the attitude of the soldier, you know, that, you know, the difference between my G.I. Joe comics and the animated series is that, you know, my comics are a lot less jingoistic. You know, any soldier will tell you that, you know, the guy that throws himself on a grenade doesn't do it for God, country, and flag. You know, he does it for the five guys in his fire team. It's personal, you know. It's you do it for your buddies. That's the way it is. There's no other way to explain it. It's hard to tell, but you know, it almost applies in a way to stuff about the bullpen. You know, that describing it out of, you know, that personal context makes it seem kind of weird and silly, because it really was weird and silly. The great thing about working at Marvel at that time was this wonderful feeling of community. That the bullpen was all part of that. And, you know, they had wonderful Halloween parties at the bullpen, and it was just, you know, wacky and fun all the time. And it was an amazing place to go to work. I didn't feel like I was, like, trudging to, like, some, you know, daily grind, you know. It was hard stuff to do. I, you know, put in long days there, but, you know, you were there doing the stuff that you liked to do with people that you liked. And you can't beat that. You know, I always felt that, you know, no matter what I was doing or whatever the circumstances, that I was like the luckiest boy in the world. Because I got to get up every morning and do the stuff that I love to do, and I got paid for it, you know. And I got to hang out with people that liked the same stuff and understood it. And you know, the community extended outside, you know, the walls of Marvel. That, you know, in the 60s, from what I know, the 70s and the 80s, you know, everybody in New York, in the comic biz, everybody knew each other and hung out together, did things together. And it was like living in a small town. You know, on opening day of Star Wars, for instance, Chris Claremont went to Lowe's Astor Plaza Theater that stood in line from 6 in the morning and saved a spot right at the front of the line. And then all the rest of us, something like 50 people from Marvel and DC showed up. You know, you let us all in, you know, and people were like really sort of pissed. But, you know, there were 50 of us. So they really couldn't say anything. And we took up the first 2 or 3 rows, you know, and we were all sitting there, some of us in altered states of various things. Or, you know, and that feeling, you know, when the battle cruiser like passes overhead, you know, experience from the first row of like one of the largest theaters in New York with like the best sound system was like, whoa! And it was impossible to describe, because, you know, you're there with everybody you know, and it's this incredible feeling, this wonderful shared experience that it's very rare to find anymore. You know, I mean, you get a little bit of it here in San Diego sometimes, but you know, it's a little diluted by the fact that you don't know every single person, you know, that's around you. You know, I remember going to see screenings at specialty houses in New York. You know, I remember I went to see Fritz Lang's Das Ring of Nibelungen, the Siegfried movies, at Carnegie Hall Cinema. They had a live organist playing the pipe organ, playing the Wagner score. So I got in a little bit late because the lights were already out. I sat through this thing, and like at the end when the lights came on, I looked around and like I literally knew every single person in the theater. It was, you know, Walt Simonson was there, and, you know, Kaluta was there, and, you know, it was everybody that I knew because it was a one night, one shot performance, you know, and you know, that sort of shared camaraderie was really wonderful, and I'm glad it happened. Yes, sir.
Of the characters that you created that weren't, I guess, based on Hasbro toys, like Hardmaster, Softmaster, Quinn, and Dr. Venom, did you sort of have an idea for those guys, or were they just based on what you needed for the plot at the time? And which one of those is your favorite?
Well, you know, lots of times I had to make up characters that were in the toy line to facilitate the storytelling. And the most vivid example of that is the Baroness, because, and she shows up in the very first issue because, you know, and a lot of this stuff doesn't become evident until you actually try to do it. You know, so I've got these 10 characters and I've got all these Cobra characters, and then when I started to like try to write it, I realized that none of the Cobra characters had any faces, which makes you know, dramaturgy and acting kind of difficult. So I thought, well, I gotta have somebody with a face that reacts to stuff that Cobra Commander says, because Cobra Commander didn't even have eyes at that point. He had this like silver mask that covered his whole face, so there were no Cobras that, like, you know, could go. Or so I said, well, okay, I'll have one Cobra who has no mask, you know. And then I said, well, okay, well, what could this character? Well, I'll make her a babe, you know, that'll help, you know. And how should she be? Well, I'll put her in like sort of a kinky bondage outfit. That should help even more, you know. And that's how she sort of came to be. You know, we cobbled it together, and I said, hey, you know, like her, we gotta like, you know, jazz this up a bit. And you know, as soon as like Hasbro saw that, they said, oh, because up until then they said, well, you know, we can't really do female action figures because, you know, 10-year-old boys, you know, would see a female action figure and they would say, well, that's a doll. You know, we don't play with dolls. So they were reluctant even to do Scarlet at first. And, but I think the Baroness really broke the ice in a lot of ways because, you know, once I saw that prototype, I knew that the ice had broken. So I looked at it and said, yeah, I want one of these. And I think, you know, a lot of other kids are going to want this too. And sure enough, it really was, she became really popular. And that's when, at the point when Hasbro said, oh, well, let's have some more female figures. And I think that was a major breakthrough there. But that was also purely not thinking about extrapolating stuff like marketing, stuff like that, but just about facilitating the storytelling. And the same thing with Quinn and the October Guard and stuff like that. I out of those characters, I think the Baroness and Quinn are still my favorites. You know, Quinn was just sort of a throwaway thing, and then I started realizing he had a lot of potential and a lot of heart. And it went part and parcel with my whole thinking about the bad guys or the enemy, you know, because one of the things that I sort of bothered me about the entire concept was that, you know, the enemy was like this sort of faceless entity. And I said, no, that I don't really go with that. You know, that if you're going to do military comic for kids, you know, somebody once said that you can't have a war until you convince everybody that the people that we're fighting are not human or are inhuman to a degree. Because it takes a lot to get somebody to, like, kill another person. You know, SLA Marshall did a huge report about this after World War II, in which he found that a startling percentage of infantry troops that he interviewed. This was after World War II, mind you, as over 80% had reported that they found it really difficult or impossible to pull the trigger on a human being. And that a surprisingly small percentage of the troops actually did all the shooting. So I realized this also when I went through basic training, that they had a thing, I don't know if they still do it, called the spirit of the bayonet, which is a bayonet drill, which is totally meant to overcome any feelings you have about sticking a pointed object into a human being. You know, just do this drill over and over again. You stick your bayonet into a life-size human dummy, you know, shouting, "Kill!" at the top of your lungs, you know. It's pretty disturbing to most people to do that. You know, even the colonel who led the charge down from Little Round Top at Gettysburg, he noted in his memoirs that, you know, because he got he had to hold the end of the line at Gettysburg, and they were out of ammo, so he instigated a bayonet charge down the hill into the advancing Confederate line. And that's what broke the line. Because at the same time that people don't like to stick sharp things into people, people really don't like to get sharp things stuck into them. It's very intimidating to see people with bayonets running down a hill at you. But yeah, that's, I wandered off the subject again. I probably asked the question. Yes, sir, here.
How hard was it to maintain story versus the need to place new toys and product in the comics?
I never had a problem with that, you know, because I did it from the very beginning. You know, lots of time, I would generate the covers first, and then I would have to figure out the story from the cover. That came about because the first year Hasbro did 4 animated commercials for the comic, okay, which were basically animated commercials for the toys. I mean, this was an incredible piece of strategy from Hasbro, who figured out that, you know, there were network rules about how many seconds of animation you could have in a toy commercial. It was very few. It was like something like 7 seconds or 6 seconds of animation. But somebody at Hasbro figured out, well, you know, if the same toys were in a comic and it was a publication, you know, there's something called the First Amendment in the Constitution of the United States, you know, which says that you can't limit anything about something published, you know. It's First Amendment writing, you know. And they said, well, if it's exactly the same toys, but it's in a comic book, we could have a 30-second commercial that's like action-packed and like completely over the top, you know. And so this was the first time a comic book was ever advertised in a TV commercial with full animation. I don't know if anybody's done it since. But in order to do those commercials, you know, like, the commercials ended with a comic book cover like spinning out, boom, freezing. And it's, you know, this month from Marvel Comics, blah, blah, blah. So, and these comics, the commercials had to be done way in advance, and they had to have the cover. So I had to, like, draw these, you know, design these covers first. So, and the only factors about the cover were, okay, this one's got to have the snowmobile in it. This one's got to have, you know, the ski surfing thing in it, you know, whatever, and these three figures and this other, you know. So I would draw, like, the most action-packed thing I could think of with these elements in it, you know, and get it on there. And then I'd get to that issue, and I'd have to, like, figure out a story that matched, you know, what went on in that cover. And sometimes, you know, if I had a whole storyline that was taking place in the Arctic, and then all of a sudden I got like a windsurfer on the next cover. I'd go, Oh, how the heck am I going to manage that, you know? But I appreciate having done that because, you know, without those rules, you know, you don't get that discipline, you know, that says, well, you know, I got to get this story to match this, whatever the parameters are, and I have to make it as good as I can, you know. And I had come up through the business working at Neil Adams' studio doing commercials, TV commercials, and you know, Neil's attitude really stuck with me, that no matter how lousy the product was, and some of these products were really lousy. I remember once we got in like these coffee bags. They were like tea bags, but they had coffee in them.
Yeah.
And like, you know, Neil would like put them in the cup of the hot water and drink it and say, oh, these are really great. We all taste this. You know, this is like crap. But he would like get all energized and charged up because that was the way he energized himself to do this really great stuff. He had to really believe, you have to really believe in it. And I still believe in it. You know, it's the Tinkerbell syndrome, you know, that, you know, if you stop believing, you know, in Tinkerbell, the fairies die, you know. And so I'd always had to keep myself wrapped up that way to really sort of believe in the characters and the storyline and keep it going no matter what. And I think a lot of people that did toy-based stuff just saw it as, you know, this is, why should I care about this, you know? But I believe that you have to care, you know, this is your work, and you have to care about every little bit of it, and that God does live in the details. So, over here.
Can you talk about the origins of the comic book, The Dam?
It was very simple. Jim Shooter came into my office one day and he had a mock-up of a cover. I think Bob Layton had said to him, "Why you should put out a comic about Vietnam." So Jim Shooter went into the bullpen and he had to put together this mock-up using the G.I. Joe cover. It was the cover of, I can't remember what the number, but it was like Stalker in, you know, cami with cami paint looking through leaves. And he had that recolored and he had a logo created that said The Nod. And he had his full mock-up. And he put this on my desk and said, well, you know, we want to put out a book called The Nod. You know, you want to edit it, you know? And I said, what's it about, you know? And he said, well, we got to cover. And I said, well, you know, I'll do this, but it may not be what you want. You know, if I'm going to do this, I'm not going to do Sergeant Fury Goes to Vietnam. You know, this is going to be the real stuff, you know, or as real as we can make it. And he said, you got it. You know, I got to give him that credit. You know, he gave me the green light. And he said, you know, whatever you have to do, you know, do it. And I tried to put together the best team I could. And I called up Doug Murray, who'd done like two tours. And I'd known him for a while. And I said, Doug, you know, this will be your baby, but, you know, I only want two things. You know, it has to be in real time. And it's got to be really real. It can't be, you know, Viet Cong running out from behind perfectly good cover and getting mowed down, you know. Inexplicable stuff has to happen, you know. A shot rings out, nobody knows where it comes from, somebody falls. You know, this is the way real stuff works, you know. And we want to make it work in a comic book form. And that first year that we came out, we got an award from the Bravo organization, which is 11 Bravo is infantry MOS. And we beat out, this is for the best media representation of the Vietnam War that year. We beat out the movie Platoon that year. As far as Bravo, the actual infantry veterans were concerned. A little funny story about that is they called me and said, we're having an award ceremony in L.A. I'm in New York, so we'd like you to come to the ceremony to receive the award. So I called up Doug Murray and I said, look, why don't you go? It's a free trip to L.A. It's a formal dinner. You're going to have to rent a tux. bring your wife. It's a free trip. Marvel will pay for this. And he said, oh, great. So he goes out there and he gets the award. And the next day he calls me. He says, you SOB, what did you set me up for? I said, what are you talking about? He said, well, we got to the ceremony. They didn't tell me that the presentation of the award for the comics came directly after, what was her name? She was the Martha Ray, who had gone on USO tours, endless USO tours to Vietnam. She was an older lady who was a big star in the 40s, and she came on stage in full camis, and sang the Ballad of the Green Berets, a cappella. And, there were all these special forces and rangers, this is the type of crowd that was in the audience, and they went bananas, getting up to accept the award for the best comic book, after that was sort of like following a little blind girl on crutches singing God Bless America. But that was true story. Anyway. Yes, sir. Yeah.
Can you talk about how you came up with Snake Eyes? And did you know about this origin that you created on the first issue? Because I was always curious why you never talked from the get-go.
No, I never knew what was going to happen on page two until I got to page two. I still don't. I write the books book by book, page by page. Oddly stream of consciousness. I didn't know, for instance, when I did issue 21, silent issue, I got to page 17 and both of the characters had rips on their sleeves, and I said, oh, wouldn't it be sort of cool if they both had the same tattoo on the same arm? And so I reused something I had used in Iron Fist, which was an I Ching hexagram. I used hexagram 63, which I used on the chest of Lake Kung the Thunderer in Iron Fist back in the 70s. And so I stuck the hexagram on their arms, but I had no idea at page 17 what the hexagram meant or what the relationship between Snake Eyes and Storm Shadow was. It was just sort of a cool thing to stick in there. This establishes sort of this mysterious relationship between the characters. But then 5 issues later, I did the origin, and I had to come up with the entire thing as a retcon, basically. Because there's really no hint that there's any connection between those two characters for the first 2 years of the book. Anybody else here?
I have a question about the end of the Marvel run. And how much lead time were you given with the end of the Marvel run? And also, what emotions did you have as it wound down?
I had about one issue in the time, so I figured, I'll just have to wind it up and say all the things that I really wanted to say. And I thought, the best way to do that would be to have Snake Eyes say it somehow, you know. So it was, it turned out to be, you know, the letter from Snake Eyes. That worked so well that I, you know, stole it from myself and used it in Wolverine. you know, the letter that Wolverine writes to Jubilee when he leaves the X-Men. You know, a good tearjerker is worth reusing, I think. Yes, sir?
Yes.
Speaking of Wolverine, I really enjoyed your run on that book. Could you speak a little bit about the thought process that went into the creative directions you took with that character?
Well, the only reason I got that book was because at the time it was completely in the cellar. So they didn't care what I did with it, you know. there was a lot of material around, you know, but I wasn't really familiar with it, you know. So I went into the X office and I said to the two or three interns, I'll take you to lunch, you know. All you got to do is tell me what you like best about Wolverine. You know, and I just took some notes, and then I went back to the Marvel library. They still had a library of bound volumes before it all got pilfered. And I read all the Barry Smith stuff and the Frank Miller stuff and the Chris Claremont versions. And I disregarded everybody else. I figured, well, you know, I like the tone of those guys' versions the best. There were things I didn't like about them. I thought I wanted to concentrate more on Wolverine's ethical core, you know, and how he resolves all these issues in his head, and that's where, you know, the character's heroism comes in is his being able to surmount all this, you know, all the strikes that he's got against him, and still, you know, have a positive attitude and get through it. And I think, you know, that's the touchstone that you have to reach about all these characters, is that, you know, I never saw G.I. Joe as a military fantasy. The core fantasy of that was always about camaraderie and loyalty and keeping faith. Because the fantasy is that, you know, that Snake Eyes will come and get you. You know, the fantasy isn't about the technicalities of violence. And the same is true about Wolverine. I think that what makes you like him is basic integrity. And I think this always has always worked. And I think that's where a lot of movie studios fall on their face, is they just see like the action, and they just see you know, the effects and stuff, and they're not realizing that, well, you know, or they're even thinking just about plots, you know. And you know, nobody comes back to read the next Harry Potter book because they thought the plot of the previous one was terrific. You like those characters and you want to spend time with the characters, and you admire various aspects of them. You know, they fulfill your fantasy of like the good friend. And if you're a kid, you know, that's a really real fantasy, because by the time you're 10, you have been betrayed by your so-called friends at one point or the other. And so the fantasy of these really faithful friends that keep you the faith really rings true. And I think it's important to keep track of. I was never a big fan of the anti-heroes. I thought, you know, if they're a hero, they have to have this ethical core. And you have to believe in that. Okay. One more question. Yes, sir.
More of a statement and not to a question, but your G.I. Joe run sustained me through childhood and probably led me to the Army in 2000 and from 2004. But going back to the character Storm Shadow, an old interview that you did said that you based the character off a character that was like essentially wrapped in one bandage. What movie was that from? Do you remember?
I don't remember the whole name of the movie. It was very long. It was about a character named Sarutobi. Sarutobi Sasuke, Sarutobi Sasuke. And it was like a very long title, like, you know, Sarutobi Sasuke Monogatari, or so, you know, it was just, and I never knew what the English translation was, but it was a black and white ninja movie, and Sarutobi is a major character in Japanese culture. There's like hundreds of anime about the young Sarutobi, but this was like the older version of Sarutobi. It was a full-blown ninja, and he was fighting this guy who was just completely white, and who was another master ninja. And at the end of the movie, you know, you found out that big spoiler that they were white because they were bandages, and the guy was a leper. You know, I thought, wow, that's really sort of kind of cool. It's weird, sort of disgusting way. That was. I think the movie is out there on disc someplace. If you Google the name, you come up with a huge long list of stuff. So it's worth checking out. And I guess that wraps me up today. I thank you all for coming.